Audible Inc. presents An Open Spook, a Haunted Guesthouse Mystery, written by E.J. Copperman, narrated by Amanda Ronconi.
Prologue. I thought you got rid of that thing years ago. My husband, Jack, was looking over my left shoulder as I rummaged through my jewelry box. I was looking for a particular pin, but Jack had noticed a half-inch-wide strip of nickel I'd stashed in the box months before. No, I assured him. I don't think I could ever get rid of it, but I put it aside after that time at Allison's.
What time at Allison's? Jack asked.
Oh, that's right. It was back when you were still refusing to go over there, I said with a sniff and rolled my eyes at him. You were being so silly about that.
It's water under the bridge and best left alone, he answered.
Jack can be sensitive about things when he knows he's in the wrong.
But remind me why this was such a big deal.
He picked it up out of the jewelry box and examined it like I hadn't owned it since before we were married.
My memory isn't what it used to be.
Let's face it, honey, I said. Nothing about you is the way it used to be. Jack and I were married for 35 years, when he was living. But since I've never had a problem seeing the dead, we were able to pick up pretty much where we left off after he passed away 5 years ago. In fact, Jack came back as a ghost in much better shape than he'd been the last couple of years he was alive. It's all really quite simple. For as long as I can remember, I've been able to see and communicate with the spirits of people who are no longer alive. To me, it's as natural to see a ghost as it is to pass a stranger on the street. I saw a program once on one of the educational stations, maybe that one that shows Honey Boo Boo, that described people like me as ghost whisperers. I think that's silly. There's no reason to whisper to a ghost any more than to a living person. Most of the time, their hearing is just fine. Things became complicated when I noticed that our daughter Allison, even at an early age, could not see ghosts the way I could. She simply was born without the ability. But she was perfect in every other way, so I let it go and decided not to say anything to her so she wouldn't feel bad about it. Instead, she learned some tricks of her father's trade. Jack was a handyman, and he liked to show our daughter how to fix things around the house. He said this was so she'd never be in need of a man just because he knew how to use a screwdriver and she didn't. Unfortunately, Allison found a different kind of man altogether and married him. The less said about Stephen, the better. But he did at least leave Allison with my granddaughter, Melissa, a level-headed, brilliant, mature beyond her years girl approaching the age of 11. Melissa could also see and hear ghosts very early on. She and I bonded over it when she was only 3 or 4, when Allison was working at a lumberyard, and I would watch my granddaughter during the time she was not in preschool. Melissa was delighted that I could see the same people she could, because she'd tried to point them out to her mother and been told her friends were imaginary, a word she didn't understand. It means mommy can't see them, I explained to her. Why not? Melissa wanted to know. Some people can draw, and some people can't draw. Some people can see all the people, and some can't.
I can draw and see all the people, Melissa said.
That's because you're a genius. As she grew, Melissa came to understand that the people only she and I could see were ghosts, and that didn't seem to bother her, because most of them seemed happy enough, she said. But after they moved into the house in Harbor Haven, Allison suffered a blow to her head while renovating, and her ability was somehow activated. She can only see about half the ghosts Melissa and I can, and she only recently was able to even see her own father, but that was his fault, and a whole different story. So we try not to lord our talents over her.
I died, Loretta. It tends to change a man.
Jack reminded me now.
Are you heading over to Allison's?
I nodded. Melissa wants to learn how to cook lasagna, and there's something Allison wants to talk about, I said. She asked for you to come. I think she's got a home improvement question.
Josh is coming, too.
Josh Kaplan is Allison's new boyfriend. She likes to ask them both about renovations to her house because Jack was a handyman when he was alive, and Josh co-owns a paint store. But since Josh can't see or hear Jack, it was best to get there early if Jack was going to be of any help. It saves so much explanation. A hat appeared on Jack's head. He never went outdoors without one.
Let's go, then. You can tell me the story about that on the way.
He was outside before me, but then I have to use doors and such. He can go through walls. Still, he'd meet me at the car, I knew, and want to open the door for me. Jack has always been a gentleman. I went to the kitchen and packed up the fixings for lasagna. Allison wouldn't have the ingredients in the house, I knew, and headed for the door, backpack over my right shoulder. The left has bursitis and has been giving me a little trouble. The idea that Jack didn't remember the search for the bracelet. I marveled. It was quite a story. How my husband could have forgotten it. Well, but then he wasn't there when it happened. Chapter 1. I knew something was wrong when the roast chicken started to walk out of the kitchen. It was a Monday evening in late October, and my daughter Allison was outside the dining room nailing plywood over the windows of the old Victorian home that she turned into a guest house in Harbor Haven, a Jersey Shore town. They say it's going to be a bad one, she said from outside. It wasn't a cold night, but the wind was already picking up. News 12 New Jersey had been going on about Frankenstorm all day, and their predictions had indeed been dire. I know, I assured her. I had to shout a little through the kitchen door so Allison could hear me through the open dining room window. It wasn't a terribly convenient system, but it was working so far. You're smart for preparing in advance. That's the only way you can prepare, she assured me. That girl keeps me on my toes. Preparing afterward doesn't really work that well. I heard the hammering get nearer. Allison was working her way toward the kitchen, which she'd already boarded up because it is the closest to the backyard, and therefore the beach. And that would be where the storm, if there was one, would no doubt hit the hardest. Allison and my granddaughter Melissa, currently upstairs doing homework after an argument about how there won't be school tomorrow anyway, Allison had told me, live in the guest house year-round. Because of the coming storm, all but one of her guests for this week had canceled, which was understandable, but unfortunate for her financially. I knew she was worried, but she wasn't letting on. The first ghosts that Allison was ever able to see were Paul Harrison and Maxine Malone. Maxine was actually the house's previous owner, and Paul was the private investigator she'd hired to look into what unfortunately turned out to be very legitimate threats against her. After recovering from the shock of discovering their existence, my savvy daughter turned it into a marketing ploy when a tour company catering to senior citizens asked for a haunted destination for tourists who want more than a time at the beach. It's a brilliant idea that Allison claims just fell into her lap, but she really doesn't give herself enough credit. However, Mr. McNamara, the lone guest who hadn't canceled, wasn't there as part of a paranormal tour. He was what Allison called a civilian guest, one who was not sent by Senior Plus Tours and did not have a desire to see ghostly activity. I hadn't met him yet, but everyone else in the house had told me he stayed in his room most of the time,
and in the 2 days he'd been there, had barely spoken to either of the residents he was capable of seeing. He was, as much as anything in the house, a mystery. "Mom, you should go home while you still have the chance," Allison said. "It's going to get dangerous to drive." "I live in Manalapan, about a half hour from Allison's house, and I could certainly understand her concern. But I knew better. I thought I'd stay here until it's over," I said, in as casual a tone as I could muster. If I kept my manner calm, I felt the response would be equally placid. No such luck. The kitchen door flew open, and Allison, wearing her tool apron and holding a hammer, appeared in the room. I hadn't realized she could move that fast. "You thought what?" she said. "Mom, you live farther inland. It's going to be safer at your house. If I thought I could talk listen to it, I'd ask you to take her to your place, but she'd just worry about me being back here." I went on with what I was doing, which was making a salad to go with the roast chicken that was in the oven as we spoke. Allison doesn't cook very much, so when I come to visit, I like to bring some good home-cooked food. She's so busy. "I can be more help here," I said, again with a very soft and natural tone. "At home, I just worry about you. This way, I can see that you and Melissa are all right." Before Allison could protest further, we both noticed a form descending from the ceiling. Maxine, a lovely young woman who passed away far too soon at the age of 28, was joining us, no doubt to see what all the noise was about. Allison's expression was less than pleased. She and Maxine pretend not to get along very well, but it's probably because they're very much alike, strong-willed and interested in home design. The chief difference, of course, is that Maxine is a ghost. Maxine floated down from the ceiling, looking at Allison with a puzzled expression. "How come it's so dark in here?" she asked. Allison let out a breath through her teeth. "I'm boarding up the windows." Maxine wrinkled her brow. "Why?" That seemed too much for Allison. "Maxie," she shouted, "there's a hurricane on the way." "So?" Maxine asked. Allison rolled her eyes and headed back outside, hefting the hammer. The banging against the outside wall resumed a few seconds later. "Thank you," I told Maxine. She smiled. "What for?" "You interrupted an argument I was having with Allison, and so I win," I informed her. The kitchen timer rang, and I checked on the chicken in the oven, which appeared to be done. I got a meat thermometer from the backpack I carry with me. Allison owns some cooking equipment, but I like to be prepared, and went back to check the temperature in the thigh. "Cool," Maxine said. "What was the argument about?" Maxine is a sweet girl, but she does think of herself as my favorite over Allison, and that's simply not going to happen. The thigh temperature was perfect at 160 degrees, so I turned the oven off and moved the chicken to an empty burner on the stove. Meat has to rest after cooking. "I told Allison I intended to stay to help out during the storm, and she wanted me to go home." Maxine pursed her lips. "I'm not sure you should stay," she said after a moment. "You'd be safer at your place. I could come with you if you want." Maxie, who had developed the ability to leave the grounds of Allison's house recently, loved to ride in the car. "I'm not lonely," I said. "I want to be helpful." From behind me, I heard the kitchen door open. "Hi, Grandma. When did you get here?" Melissa walked over to a bowl of apples and picked one up. "Hey, Maxie." "A little while ago," I answered. "Is your homework done?" "Homework?" Maxie sputtered. "There's a hurricane coming and she's got homework?" "That's what I said," my granddaughter agreed. I put some asparagus in a serving dish with water and covered it with plastic wrap, then put the dish into the microwave. You'll see, I told Melissa. There might not even be a bad storm, and you'll feel better knowing that your homework is done and you don't have to worry about it. That's what Mom said. She's right. And don't eat that apple. We're having dinner in 10 minutes. I started draining some of the drippings from the pan into a measuring cup. I would use them to make gravy. Melissa scowled and put the apple back into the bowl. You're harshing my mellow, Grandma, she said. It was a favorite expression. The girl is adorable. Nonetheless. Come on, Melissa, Maxine said. Let's go upstairs and I'll dye your hair blue. Maxine likes to think of herself as Melissa's roommate. Melissa giggled and started for the stairs, while Maxine took the more direct route, through the ceiling. I doubted Melissa's hair really would be a different color when she returned for dinner, especially since it would be so soon. But that was the least of my worries at the moment. Because when I looked up, the roast chicken had raised itself out of its bed of carrots and apples and seemed to will itself over the edge of the roasting pan and then, in midair, toward the kitchen door. Chapter 2. As I've said, I pride myself on seeing every ghost in my path, but there are a lot of them, and they vary in their intensity. By that, I mean the spirits I see have levels of energy. Some could easily pass for living people because they're very strong and vibrant. They have color and depth. The majority, like Maxine and Paul, have an average amount of energy. Their voices don't echo like in the movies, but sound less forceful than a living person's. And the ghosts are less colorful in appearance, given that light seems to go through them. They can interact with physical objects to various degrees, but they can pass through them, too. There are some, however, who have very little physical energy. This type of spirit can be seen, but it requires a good deal of concentration. I believe it indicates their energy is either very new, they died not long ago and haven't established themselves on this level of existence yet, or waning, as the spirit might be ready to move on to the next plane, whatever that is. This kind of ghost is almost transparent to the eye. Allison can't always sense these ghosts, and even Melissa sometimes has some difficulty with them. I usually don't have that trouble. But when I saw the flying roast chicken, I had to assume I was in such a presence. Can I help you? I asked in the direction of the chicken. The chicken stopped moving. I turned toward it, away from the stove and in the direction of the door, and squinted just a little to block out some of the light from the overhead fixture, because direct light can sometimes cancel out the ghost's form. Sure enough, I began to see the dim outline of a man, tall and straight. His face wasn't very visible, so I couldn't read his expression. He stood, or floated, to be more accurate, very still, seeming stunned that I had seen him. He did not speak. I can't imagine you're hungry, I told the man. Spirits don't need to eat, of course. So may I ask what you need with our dinner? The man moved a little closer to me, and for a second looked like he was going to drop the chicken, but managed to place it carefully back in the Pyrex baking dish. As he gained substance, I could see he was in his late 20s or early 30s, dressed in army fatigues. His uniform held some indication of rank, but I don't know much about such things. It's not for me, he said, indicating the chicken. It's for friends. Friends? I asked. The ghost's mode of dress and age were not necessarily an indication of when the man had died. Some spirits take on the look of another time, usually a happier one in their lives. This doesn't happen all the time, but then I had discovered there are no definites concerning the afterlife. Everyone's seems to be a different experience. If your friends are hungry, maybe we can find something for them to eat without giving up our own dinner.
My friends are homeless, the ghost said. They live on the beach not far from here. There is a very bad storm brewing.
How many friends are you talking about? I asked. Something about his tale didn't add up. I figured I should keep him talking.
8, the soldier said, after thinking about it.
That chicken isn't going to feed 8 hungry people, I noted.
It's going to be a very bad storm,
he repeated, as if that explained the discrepancy. Then food is not their biggest problem, I told him. We should call the police and get them to a shelter before this becomes dangerous. They'll get food there. I took a few steps toward the new arrival, and Paul rose up out of the basement and through the stove. Usually Paul has better aim than that, and startled the new ghost, new to us anyway, when his face appeared directly in front of the chicken. The soldier's shoulders shuddered, but Paul stopped and looked at him, smiling.
Did I miss something, Loretta? He asked me. Why not introduce me to your friend?
Mostly because I don't know his name, I said. I turned to the newcomer. I'm Loretta Kirby, and this is my friend, Paul Harrison. What should we call you, dear? The new ghost had turned back toward me after Paul spoke, still visibly shaken by his arrival. I suppose ghosts don't always see other ghosts coming either.
Sergeant Robert Elliott, United States Army, he said.
For a moment, I thought he'd give us his serial number as well, but instead he added,
I owned this house once, a long time ago.
It took me a moment to absorb that, but Paul was quicker to respond.
When was that? He asked.
It's always tricky when a ghost talks about time. For them, a long time ago could be 3 months or it could be the Revolutionary War. Paul had been a private investigator when he was alive, and he likes nothing better than to ask questions. It keeps his mind sharp, he says. He'd even gone so far as to convince Allison to get a private investigator's license so she could go out and do some digging for him on what he calls his cases. Allison is very clever at it, but she's never quite taken to the idea of being a detective and doesn't like to put herself, or especially Melissa, in danger, so she often resists the jobs Paul accepts on her behalf.
I bought it in 1968,
Sergeant Elliott said with an absent tone, as if he were thinking about something else.
I didn't live here very long. It was sold in the early 70s.
He was getting less visible, more transparent as his voice became ethereal. I had to get him to focus on the conversation or he might fade away. The memory seemed to be overpowering him. Why? I asked. If you had the house for such a short time, why did you sell it?
I was about to get married, so I bought the house for me and my fiancée, Barbara Litton, the sergeant answered. But then I was inducted into the Army, and we decided to postpone the wedding until I came back.
He stopped, closed his eyes, and opened them again.
I did not return alive.
This was not explaining the walking roast chicken. But there's no point in rushing some people, alive or dead, when they're telling you a story. I'm so sorry, I said. What happened?
A landmine in Tua Tienhui province, he said simply. Vietnam, Paul said to me. Late 1960s. 1970, to be precise. Sergeant Elliott responded. I don't remember the exact date. The incident is a little confused in my memory.
Is that why you came back here? I asked. To jog your memory? Robert's head snapped down to look at me, and he seemed more focused, but almost annoyed.
No, I came for the food for my friends.
I still didn't believe that claim, but I thought I'd play along to see what Paul could find out.
I'll call the police right now about seeing to your friends, I said, and got my cell phone from my backpack.
Allison teases me about looking like a third grader, but the backpack carries everything I need and keeps my hands free when I'm walking. It helps with my posture, too. I stepped into the dark dining room, where the windows were all boarded up now as Allison had moved around the house to work on the game room. I turned on the lights and called the Harbor Haven police. And after a lengthy delay, the storm was causing a lot of panicky calls to the police headquarters, was informed by the dispatcher that they were aware of the enclave of homeless people living in town and had taken them to shelters in the area for the duration of the weather event. Paul and Robert had clearly been talking during my conversation, because when I returned to the kitchen, they were hovering next to each other by the center island. Paul turned to me with a look on his face I recognized. He had a case to solve.
Loretta, he said with great enthusiasm, Robert has asked us to conduct a search on his behalf.
You want us to find your fiancé? I asked Robert.
He shook his head.
No. She was informed of my status and married another man in 1978. But there was something that belonged to her, something that was linked to me, and it seems to have vanished when Barbara sold the house.
What is it we're looking for? I asked. Robert's eyes were clearer and more substantial than I'd seen them before. He looked right at me and asked,
Do you know what a POW bracelet is?
Chapter 3.
What's a POW bracelet?
Paul asked. We were situated around the center island in the kitchen, Paul, Maxine, and myself. Allison was still battening down the hatches for the storm, and Melissa was finishing her homework. Paul was hovering over the stove, giving the false impression of a man who needed the warmth to keep himself aloft. Maxine was lying on her side in a horizontal position, floating by the refrigerator, which made it more uncomfortable to get out salad dressing than it might normally be. Maxine didn't seem to notice. Paul stroked his goatee, which made him look professorial. He's such a nice boy. Now that I've known him for a while, it's even more upsetting to me that he died so young. His case with Maxine had been the first he'd undertaken himself. Paul told me he'd apprenticed at a detective agency and had just started on his own. If the attack hadn't happened so soon, he undoubtedly would have anticipated and foiled it. But it was just bad luck. Since then, he and Allison have proven to be a very good investigative team, and I like to watch them work together. It makes Paul happy to be useful, and it makes Allison, well, she underestimates her talents. Paul had conducted a fairly thorough interview of the spirit he was now calling our client, Sergeant Elliot. The lost item in question was a POW bracelet. I explained to Paul that various student groups during the Vietnam War used to make these simple metal bands with the names of missing soldiers on them and sell them for a few dollars to raise funds protesting the war or just to focus attention on military personnel who had been listed as missing or taken prisoner. Usually, people just got bracelets with random names. But this one was special.
Barbara had specifically asked for one with my name, and the families of those lost overseas usually got at least one, Sergeant Elliot had told us.
So what happened to this one, The one Barbara had with your name? I asked. The soldier looked irritated.
I don't know, he answered. But I know she still had it after I made it back here to the States.
They found our remains, some of us, and shipped them home for a group burial. But they weren't able to identify mine, so I was still listed as missing. All I know is she wore it until she sold this house, and then it was gone. I think it might still be here.
I decided to keep working on getting dinner ready as I listened to the interview, but I couldn't remember exactly what I'd been doing when the chicken had started walking. Oh, yes. I'd been rendering pan drippings to make gravy. Now, where had I put that measuring cup?
Here, Paul said. I've been here for a couple of years, and I don't believe I've seen anything like that. I believe it's here, Sergeant Elliot repeated. I don't know the place well. I didn't live here long, only a few months before I shipped out. I've done a little searching, but I don't know the idiosyncrasies of the house. You might have better luck.
Why do you need it? I asked. After all these years, and after knowing his fiancé had married another man, what kind of significance could it still hold?
It's very important I get it, he said. If I hold it in my hand, I believe I can end this half-existence.
Paul looked intrigued. The idea of other levels of an afterlife was always a fascinating concept for him.
You think the bracelet is the key? He asked.
I don't know for certain, but I feel it has a hold on me, the sergeant answered. I think that if I can gain possession of it, its restrictive power will vanish.
Really?
Paul stroked his goatee harder, a sure sign he was thinking deeply.
What's this all got to do with the chicken? I asked. The question had been bothering me the whole conversation, and my inability to find the measuring cup was just as annoying. I didn't get an answer. Sergeant Elliot vanished.
What's a POW bracelet? Melissa asked.
It was a special thing, I answered my granddaughter. It was a metal bracelet people wore during and after the Vietnam War. Each one had the name of a soldier who had been captured or was missing, and the date he had last been seen. Melissa thought about it as she chewed a bite of chicken, and then asked, after swallowing, like a good girl does,
"So it's like those ribbons or rubber bracelets people wear now to raise awareness for a disease or something?"
I nodded. The wind was starting to howl around the house, but the rain hadn't started yet. Allison was looking up at the ceiling, where Maxine was stretching as if she were going to, or could, sleep.
So this ghost wants us to find the bracelet with his name on it?
Why does he think it's here?
He says he dropped in on his ex-fiancé and overheard a conversation about it years ago. I reported, based on what Robert had told me. She thought she'd packed it with her, and then when she got to her new apartment, she couldn't find it. Apparently, that was very troubling to her, and even after she was informed that he was listed as missing, and then as killed in action, she wasn't able to let it go. Paul was clearly thinking ahead to the search.
Maxie and I can search inside the walls, and in places you can't look. If we all begin looking after dinner, it shouldn't take very long at all.
If the ghost looked himself and couldn't find it, why does he think we can? Melissa asked.
Allison answered for Paul.
We don't have another plan, so we might as well go with this one.
But I want to point out that nobody still breathing is going outside tonight. Is that clear?
From all reports, this is a really dangerous storm, and I don't want anything bad to happen to anyone. She looked at Melissa.
Especially you.
You worry too much, Maxine told her. If anyone has to go outside, I'll do it. Nothing's going to happen to me out there.
I thought that was what I just said,
Allison muttered. Paul knows when to nip their arguments in the bud.
He also focuses on his cases very acutely. He's very responsible.
While we're looking for the bracelet, Maxie, I think you should run some computer searches.
Maxine does the research on the investigations, and even though she likes to grumble about it, she's very talented at what she does. It makes me proud that it was originally my suggestion she take up that part of the job.
I'm good, she told Paul, but there's no computer database on Earth that's going to tell us where a lost bracelet might be in this house.
Maybe not, Paul agreed. But it might provide an image of the bracelet so we all know what we're looking for.
Sometimes I forget how young they all are. Paul and Maxine were both barely born in the 1970s. Allison is in her late 30s now, and Melissa? Well, she's young enough to be my granddaughter. Of course none of them would know what a POW bracelet looks like. There's nothing I like better than being helpful. So I pulled back the sleeve on my blouse and reached for my left wrist. They look like this, I said. I've been wearing a POW bracelet, along with a few other pieces of jewelry, almost every day for a very long time. I pulled it off and placed it on the island between plates of chicken and rice. It was a theatrical gesture, I know, that I hadn't shown them my bracelet already, but I do sometimes relish the spotlight. The group of them stared at me, then at the simple metal, I think it's nickel, bracelet, whose inscription read, Colonel William Mason, 52268. Allison blinked a few times and shook her head a little. How did you know to bring that, Mom? I waved a hand at her. Don't be silly. I wear it sometimes, out of respect for Colonel Mason. But not all the time. It gets hot in the summer, so I take it off, and it doesn't go with everything I put on. You don't see them that much anymore. At one time, everybody I knew wore one. You're supposed to wear it until the person whose name is on your bracelet, or his remains, come home.
Wow, Grandma, Melissa said. You're way cool.
I laughed in spite of myself. You have no idea, sweetie, I told her. In 1970, I was a junior at Monmouth College, which is now Monmouth University in West Long Branch, New Jersey. I had just declared a history major, but only because I had been required to declare something. Otherwise, I would have happily studied whatever happened to capture my interest until someone, probably my parents who were paying most of my bills, told me to stop. But I don't believe in the war, I was telling my friend Marilyn Beachman as she wrapped a strip of metal around my left wrist. Marilyn was not the kind of person who allowed anything like waiting for permission to stand in her way. I'm against it. So am I, she assured me. Vietnam is a huge mistake, but that's the point of this bracelet. She finished bending it around my wrist and took her hands away to admire it. See? You show your opposition by reminding people that soldiers like... Marilyn stopped to read the inscription on the bracelet. Colonel Mason are being held against their will, maybe dying, because we're participating in an illegal war. You know Congress has never declared war on Vietnam at all? I looked at the metal strip, which resembled something they'd put on your arm when you were admitted to a hospital.
It's ugly.
Exactly.
No, the bracelet. It looks bad on my arm.
I held it out again so she could see what I meant. Marilyn frowned and shook her head. It was only $3. And I think it looks good on you. Besides, you only have to wear it until Colonel Mason comes home or the North Vietnamese tell us what happened to him. Then you can take it off.
I can't ever take it off before then? I asked. That seemed impractical.
Well, when you're in the shower and stuff, of course you can take it off, she answered. You don't want it to rust on your arm or anything. I mean, you can't take it off forever until we find out what happened to the guy. How long could that take?
I hadn't been terribly active in the anti-war movement, or at least not as active as I thought I should have been, deep down. I participated in moratoriums, but didn't go to sit-ins or anything like that. I didn't like the idea of young men dying, especially when I didn't really understand what the war was about. And if this strip of metal on my arm could show I believed in peace, like John and Yoko were saying, then I didn't see the harm in it. As long as it's only temporary, I told Marilyn. She waved a hand. A few months, tops, she said. Over 40 years after first putting it on, I considered the bracelet. I hadn't really thought about it in years. It had just become something I put on some days and not others, without paying much attention. It's pretty worn out, I said, probably more to myself than anyone else. It's old, Maxine said, then seemed to catch herself. She put her hand to her mouth. Sorry, Mrs. Kirby. I'm not offended. I'm just showing it to you because that's the kind of thing we'd be searching for. I looked up at Paul. He seemed deep in thought. Allison started clearing the table, and Melissa stood to help. They are a very well-oiled machine, those two. Allison seemed nervous. Out of habit, she kept glancing toward the windows, which were boarded up, as if she were able to see something outside. I wonder if I should have put the car somewhere else, she said. Is yours okay, Mom? I parked behind you, I told her. Was that okay, or do you think I should move it? My daughter gave me a look that spoke volumes. Were you paying attention when I said nobody goes outside tonight? She asked. Listen to that wind. It was indeed making eerie noises outside the house, like the kind in ghost movies on television. Of course, wind has nothing to do with actual spirits. The cars will be fine, I assured her. Paul looked impatient. The weather didn't affect him, and he gets fidgety when the subject strays off a problem he's considering. While you're at the computer, Maxie, it wouldn't hurt to do some searches on Robert Elliott. Maybe we can find out something that Robert hasn't told us. Or maybe we can find another of his POW bracelets on eBay or something, in case Barbara's proves hard to locate. Allison furrowed her brow. Yeah? And whose money are you using for that? She asked.
Don't be a cheapskate, Maxine told her. We're talking about a war veteran's peace of mind here.
Sure, you don't have to put anyone through college. Maxine, looking offended, flew up through the ceiling and vanished.
That bothers Maxie, Paul told Allison.
What does? When you remind her she'll never be a mom, I reminded her gently. But I didn't say that, Allison protested.
That's what she heard, Paul said.
Allison sat down on one of the bar stools next to the island. It's not what I meant, she said. Paul held up his hands in front of his chest.
Don't worry, she'll get over it, he told Allison. Let's stay on task, shall we?
I saw Allison's eyebrow twitch just a little, and I knew what that meant. One reason she'd decided to go into business for herself is that she hates to be bossed around. She turned toward Paul.
Okay, let's. Why don't you go off into your corner and get a message out on the Ghosternet?
Paul has the ability to communicate with other spirits. It's sort of a telepathic thing, from what I understand, and it involves him being off on his own for a while so he can concentrate on the messages he sends and receives exclusively. Allison calls it the Ghosternet. I just love that. He looked a trifle surprised.
Who would I be trying to contact? He asked. Anybody who knew Robert Elliott? People in his army unit, maybe? For that matter, Robert Elliott. I also want to know why he bolted so quickly if he wants us to help him. Don't you?
Just then, Maxine descended from the ceiling wearing a trench coat a few sizes too large for her. That usually means she's carrying something.
The ghosts, if they hide an object in their clothing, can bring it through solid objects like walls. If they carry it outside their clothes, whatever they're carrying hits the wall and won't move. It's a funny little trick. I often wonder what a physicist would make of it. I've asked a few, but they were already ghosts and took it for granted. Sure enough, Maxine pulled Allison's laptop computer out from under her coat.
All right, what am I supposed to be looking up?
She asked. That was the very moment when all the lights in the house went out. The howling of the wind outside seemed much louder now. Okay, Allison said after a moment. Things just got a little bit more difficult. Chapter 4 Mr. McNamara, Allison's lone guest for the week, arrived back from dinner in town not long after. Although Allison usually doesn't serve food to the guests, she told me she'd invited him to eat with us because of the upcoming storm, but Mr. McNamara had declined, saying he liked the wind, and the rain, when he'd left, hadn't started in earnest yet. I hadn't yet met Mr. McNamara, who insisted on being called Mac, so I was a little surprised to see a man in his late 60s, a few years older than I am, wearing worn jeans, a long-sleeved, tie-dyed shirt, and an American flag headband that kept his shoulder-length, straight gray hair out of his eyes. Very Willie Nelson. Allison handed him a towel to dry his hair and face, introduced us, and assured her guest that she'd taken every precaution to ensure the safety of the house and everyone in it. Also, she'd put a battery-powered heater in Mac's bedroom. I was proud to see she was such a caring and intelligent innkeeper. The only other such unit was in Melissa's attic bedroom. Mac seemed completely unconcerned about his safety. He just smiled, dabbed at his eyes a bit while his clothes dripped on the kitchen floor, shrugged, said, "It's all cool, man." Then asked if there was a policy against smoking in the house. Allison told him there was after glancing at Melissa. But again, her guest seemed unperturbed.
"Okie dokie," he said. "Thought I might go back to my room and dig the storm from inside for a while. Okay if I play the harmonica?"
Allison assured him that would be fine and asked him to come out and play for all of us, but he insisted he wasn't skilled enough to play for an audience. There were three flashlights in use at the moment, one for Allison, one for Melissa, and one for me. The rest of the house was illuminated by candlelight. I offered my flashlight to Mac, but he declined, saying the candles gave off a much more mellow light. It's possible he used the word groovy, and then quietly walked toward his room, guided by a beam from Allison's flashlight. She had left two candles in his room.
"What is his deal?"
Maxine wondered aloud as soft harmonica music began.
"Has he been in storage for the past 45 years?
"Maxie," Allison warned.
"What? I kind of like him."
"Let's get back to the subject," Paul reminded her. "Our case?"
Clearly, with the power off, we had been forced to reconsider our plans. Allison could not, as she'd planned, give each of the ghosts a flashlight for looking inside walls and other spaces where the rest of us couldn't go. We needed the flashlights just to get around. And there would be no internet access until there was power, so Maxine was unable to do any research. Even cell phone use had to be limited to absolute necessity, Allison pointed out, because we had no idea when our phones could be charged again.
"We can charge them in the car," Melissa pointed out. "We still have chargers out there."
Allison nodded. She always treats Melissa like an intelligent, responsible person and doesn't talk down to her the way some people do to their children.
"That's true. But we'd be using up gas, and we don't know if the gas station's power is out, too," she explained. "Why don't you go get the little radio?"
so we can find out a little of what's going on. Melissa ran toward the stairs with her flashlight and up toward her room, where she had a little battery-operated transistor radio that looks like a race car. We can get the news, at least, as long as that's working. You should have gone home when you had the chance, Allison told me. I would have gone home if I'd wanted to, I told her. But I didn't want to. You are incorrigible, my daughter scolded. You can't be corriged. The harmonica music had faded away by the time Maxine, almost completely invisible in the dim light of the candles, swooped down from the ceiling.
I was up on the roof, she said. There's like all kinds of wind going on out there. I saw a whole tree fall over 3 houses down. It missed the house, but that blue Oldsmobile down the street has made its last run to the grocery store.
We won't be able to search for the bracelet until sunlight. Paul's voice came from over me and to the right somewhere. I couldn't see him at all. The bracelet is the least of our worries right now, Allison said. I hope the house is still all in one piece by morning. Her, I could see, and she looked extremely worried. Her expression changed completely when Melissa's footsteps could be heard on the stairs approaching us. She smiled bravely and looked up for her daughter. Got the radio? She asked.
Yeah, but it's not working. I don't know the last time we changed the batteries.
Melissa's voice wavered a little. The reality of the situation, being cut off in the dark and in the middle of a massively powerful storm, was beginning to set in. Don't worry, baby, Allison assured her. I have a lot of batteries in the fridge. I'll tell you what, you and Grandma change out the batteries in the radio, and I'm going to go start a fire in the fireplace so we can have some light and a little heat for a while. How's that? Allison didn't wait for an answer, but headed for the den where the fireplace was. I took Melissa by the hand and brought her to the refrigerator, but I caught her hand when she reached for the handle. Remember, honey, I said, there's no power coming to the fridge now, so we're going to open it only when we really have to, and we're going to be really fast about getting what we need. If the power stays off for a while, we might have to cook everything in there. But if it comes back on soon, we'll be keeping everything inside cold, okay? Melissa got a look on her face that made her so closely resemble Allison in the dim light, I almost did a double take. There's not that much in there to cook, Grandma, she said. A couple of eggs, a tube of cinnamon rolls, and I think some apples, maybe. There were also the remnants of the dinner I'd cooked tonight, and some extra supplies I'd brought with me. Melissa didn't know that yet. And some batteries, I reminded her. Ready? Melissa nodded, so I opened the refrigerator door and pointed the flashlight inside. She stuck her hand in like a dart and came out with a package of C batteries. I closed the door as soon as her hand cleared it. Good job, I said. We had just replaced the batteries in the radio when Allison walked back into the kitchen. That's great, she said when she heard the static. Can you find the news station? It took a little doing, but we tuned in an all-news station from New York. The news was not at all encouraging. Hurricane Sandy is wreaking havoc all through the area. Power is out for tens of thousands of homes on Long Island, and we're starting to hear reports of water in Lower Manhattan, the newscaster intoned. New Yorkers, it's all about them. This could be a while, Allison said, looking at Paul. Indeed. I think Maxie and I should alternate keeping a watch on the outside. Make sure no serious damage is done to the house if we can. Allison grinned what she'd call her dopey grin, her eyes filling just a little. Thanks to both of you, she said.
What do you mean, both of you? Maxine asked. I didn't agree to that plan.
But she rose through the ceiling to take the first shift on the roof, which is one of her favorite spots anyway. Allison looked at me. Check your cell phone, she said. It's weird that I haven't heard from Jeannie or Tony. Jeannie and her husband Tony were Allison's closest friends, and she was right. It was unusual for them not to have called to see how she and Melissa were weathering the wind and rain, and to let us know how they and their infant son were handling the storm at their home in La Valette. But one look at each of our phones showed that they were both without service. The tower must be out, Allison said. There isn't anything we can do right now, I replied. Come on, let's go into the den and enjoy the fire. We walked into the den, the largest room in the house, with its very tall and lovely wood-burning fireplace. With the windows boarded, it seemed darker than it would have otherwise, even though night had clearly fallen by now. Allison had put just two logs on the fire, though, and I saw that the pile of wood next to it was pretty paltry. She caught me giving the wood pile a doubtful look and said, I have some more in the shed. But nobody's going outside tonight, Melissa reminded her. Allison hugged her daughter. That's right, baby. This should do us, though, and when you go to bed, we'll take one or two of the guest blankets to keep you extra warm. Even with the ones I gave Mac, there's still plenty for us. Allison, Paul interrupted. Since we have the time, perhaps we can focus on the search we've undertaken on behalf of Robert Elliott. Allison closed her eyes for a moment in a gesture of frustration, I think. We're in the middle of a hurricane, and we can't really start searching until it's light in here, she reminded him. What is there to talk about? But Paul seemed prepared for that question. The real reason he wants to find that bracelet, he said. What do you mean? Melissa asked. Don't you think he wants it because his name is on it? It's possible he's telling the truth, Paul said, pacing in midair as he did when he was thinking through a problem. But from what you've told me, Loretta, there were hundreds, maybe thousands of these bracelets distributed. Would he need to collect every single one in order to evolve to the next level? Melissa looked into the fire. It was always fascinating to watch the flames, but I think she was considering. Maybe his... What's the word when it's the thing that's how you look at stuff? Perspective? Allison offered. Yeah, perspective. Maybe his perspective is different after all these years. Maybe it changed when he died. Did yours change, Paul? Melissa can be very direct. Paul doesn't like to be reminded that he's no longer alive. But this time it didn't seem to bother him because it was in service of his case. Yes, in some ways, he answered, stroking his beard. There are some things I don't care very much about anymore, like the clothes I'm wearing or who's elected to office. I do still keep track of the football scores. When Paul says football, he means soccer. He was born in England and grew up in Canada. But that's more a way of passing the time now. Did you care less about the people you knew? Allison asked. I knew that when she first discovered Paul and Maxine, she'd asked if there was anyone he wanted her to contact, and Paul had declined. But later, he had asked her to find a woman he'd been especially fond of when he was alive, just to see if she was all right. That ended up being quite a story. I don't think so, Paul said after a moment. The ones I cared about were still on my mind, although it's possible I've forgotten some and don't know it. But Robert Elliott has been a ghost for more than 40 years. How is this relevant to his wanting to find the POW bracelet? It raises questions, Allison asked. Why did Robert wait all these years to look for this one bracelet? Why is this the one that makes all the difference? Paul nodded, digesting the question. As he thought, probably without noticing, he lowered through the air to floor level. You're doing better and better as an investigator, Allison, he said, as if the rest of us didn't know that already. I wouldn't have thought to ask that. I don't understand, Melissa said, getting closer to the fire.
Sergeant Elliot asked us to find the bracelet. Does it matter why he wants it? Paul's eyes, difficult to see in this light, seemed squinted. He paced more quickly, an action made all the more strange by the fact that he was up to his ankles in floor.
Not necessarily, he said. But Robert has all the same abilities as Maxie and me. He could have searched this house from top to bottom any time he wanted to in the past 40 years. Why haven't we seen him before? Why didn't he find the bracelet himself?
What reason would he have to lie to us? I asked.
A good question indeed, Paul said.
We had no time to ponder it because there was a loud crash from somewhere inside the house. Allison leapt up at the first sound.
Was that a window? She asked, and didn't wait for an answer.
She ran toward the main entrance room, the area where the sound seemed to have come from. Melissa and I followed immediately, but as it turned out, Paul beat us all to the front room.
I think it came from there, he said,
pointing toward the largest guest bedroom Allison has in the house, the one with its own private bath just off the stairwell up to the second floor.
That's Mac's room, Allison said.
Paul? But Paul was already heading toward the door. He was stopped there by Maxine, who must have heard the noise from outside and come directly down through the room. She emerged through the door to Mac's room, holding up her hands.
He's okay, she said. He fell out of bed.
Oh, my, I said. But he's all right? Maxine assured us Mac was unharmed. Allison knocked on his door anyway, since he couldn't have been aware anyone had checked on him. Mac called out that he was all right, but that it would be best if Allison didn't come in, since he was, as he put it, dressed for bed.
You don't want to know, Maxine said. And he's right. Don't go in.
All right, Mac, Allison said through the door. Call me if you need me. As we headed back into the den and toward the fire, the only warm spot we could reach right now, Paul, who seemed suspicious of the incident, asked Maxine for a full report.
He was lying next to the bed, she said, as we reached the fire.
The ghosts, of course, didn't care about temperature, but Allison, Melissa, and I huddled by the fire and threw blankets around ourselves.
Luckily, his sheet covered up most of his bottom half.
What position was he in?
Paul asked, his eyes narrowed. He expected a certain answer, I could tell, though I couldn't imagine what.
The candle was blown out, so I couldn't see much. But it looked like he'd landed on his left side. He didn't seem hurt.
Maxine had her eyes closed to think. I often wonder if the ghosts can see through their eyelids, which are somewhat transparent, but this didn't seem the moment to ask.
What else? Paul asked.
Maxine opened her eyes.
His left arm was stretched out in front of him, but it was dark. I couldn't see if he had something in his hand or anything.
Paul's jaw moved back and forth.
Good. Nice work, Maxie.
Oh. But that's not the weird part, Maxine offered.
Allison, eyebrow cocked and lips twisted, said, Okay, Maxie, what's the weird part?
I saw someone like us, a woman, making her way out of the room and through the wall to the outside.
Maxine grinned. She loves knowing something others don't. Melissa's eyes widened.
Another ghost?
Chapter 5.
It's all speculation, Paul said. Maxie saw a ghost in Mac's room, but she didn't see the ghost do anything and didn't really get a good look, other than to say it was female. We don't know anything yet.
After some discussion about Maxine's description of the scene in Mac's room, Paul had suggested he and Maxine search the house for unknown ghosts, but they found no one at all, not even Sergeant Elliot. Now, in the den, as the fire started to die down,
He was cautioning us not to jump to conclusions.
"We have no evidence," he went on. "In fact, we don't even know for sure that anything happened, other than a person like Maxie and me was passing by just when Mac happened to fall out of bed. For all we know, he does that twice a week."
"Yeah, but isn't it a big coincidence?" Melissa asked. "Aren't you always saying we shouldn't trust coincidences in an investigation?"
She's so grown up. "I'm not saying we should trust it, and I'm not saying the spirit in the room didn't do something to your guest, Allison. What I'm saying is we don't know what happened yet. There was little that could be done before morning. Without electricity, Maxine could not do any internet research, even if the battery on the somewhat outdated laptop could hold out for more than a few minutes, and Allison assured me it wouldn't. There was no working internet connection in the house. We'd have to venture outside to find one, and the radio's news reports grew more and more dire as the night went on. Allison had been right. We'd stay inside for the duration. We could hear the wind howling outside. Maxine reported on the damage she'd seen, which in this area seemed to be mostly downed branches, but large ones.
It's pretty bad. I couldn't see any lights on for miles around. No street lights, no traffic lights, no neon signs, nothing. Maybe you should have evacuated.
There was no evacuation order, or I would have, Allison said. You could see all that from the roof? Maxine shook her head.
The sign on top of the Dunkin' Donuts on Route 35.
We can't expect the power to come on too soon.
What can we do now, Paul? Allison asked. I think she was trying to change the subject, because Melissa looked just a little scared, and Allison hates frightening her daughter.
Sleep, the ghostly investigator suggested. It's not going to do you much good to sit up tonight, and we can't do any searching or research until tomorrow. Let me know if you see Maxie's female ghost.
I don't want to go upstairs with the fire still burning, my daughter said.
I'll take care of it, I told her. I don't feel like sleeping just yet. You and Melissa go on up. I wasn't very sleepy. I've always been a little antsy during thunderstorms, and even though there was no thunder tonight, this had the same dangerous feel to it. Maybe more dangerous. Allison considered.
You want to spend the night in my room, Liz? She asked.
I'm not a 4-year-old anymore, Melissa protested, her voice a little shaky, betraying her true feelings.
Of course you're not, but I'm cold. I'll bring the heater down from your room and we can both be warm.
It was Melissa's turn to consider for a moment.
Okay, she said.
Allison put an arm around her daughter and was even gracious enough not to give me a knowing look as she led Melissa upstairs. Once they were out of earshot, I crossed my arms and pulled the blanket closer around my shoulders. The wool was scratchy, but I like it that way.
Okay, Paul, I said. Melissa's gone. Now tell me what you really think is going on.
I don't know, he said. We have a long list of things we don't know, and a very short list of things we can be sure about.
We don't know anything, Maxine interjected.
I knew Paul was just warming up, so I'd stayed silent. But Maxine's not always adept at picking up on signals from other people. Patience is not her strongest suit.
We can't even be sure what Sergeant Elliot really wants, she continued.
What reason would he have to lie? I asked. We're not going to stop looking for the bracelet if it's that important to him. Why not just say what he means?
I confess, I don't always understand what makes people lie.
I'm sure there's a reason Allison won't tell people besides the family and her senior plus guests that she can see ghosts, but I've never felt embarrassed about my gift and will mention it to anyone who asks.
I'm not sure this is all about the bracelet, Paul said.
Maybe he wants us to search the house in some way that he can't, or that he wouldn't think to do. He wants us to find something.
Nobody goes this nuts over some little strip of metal that isn't worth $5, Maxie said, as if it were obvious. What's important is he wants out of this type of existence. He thinks somehow we can help him do it. I wished my husband Jack were there. Jack would have had a good idea of how to cut through the fog and understand what was important. It was a specialty of his. I wondered what he would say about Sergeant Elliot's true motivations. So, I imagined his reply.
This man's name is on the bracelet, and he needs it to achieve some kind of peace. That could make sense. What doesn't add up is that he's so set on one being here in the house. What about all the others? Why is this particular one so important?
That made sense. Jack was so helpful, even when he wasn't there. The only tool we have that's still working is you, Paul, I said. Maybe you'd better try and locate Sergeant Elliot.
Paul looked resigned to his task and nodded. I'll be back, he said.
Before he left, I asked him to get in touch with Jack and let him know I was all right. He agreed and dropped through the floor to the basement, one of his favorite hiding places. If you don't mind me leaving you alone, I'm going back out to watch the storm, Maxine said from the ceiling. It's pretty cool when you can't get wet.
I waved her off, saying it was fine, and she, too, vanished. I tried to resist the temptation to turn on the radio. Who knew when we'd be able to get more batteries? But I checked in about once an hour. The reports got progressively worse, and at about 2 in the morning, the radio station we'd been tuned to lost its power, and static replaced the reports. It took me 10 minutes to find another news outlet that was still broadcasting. Reports of downed wires and tree limbs abounded. Hundreds of thousands were, like us, without electricity, and flooding was already overtaking a good part of the Jersey Shore. We hadn't gotten any water in the house yet, but that didn't mean we wouldn't. And even if the house itself remained unscathed, the area was taking a beating. I wasn't sure when Allison might be able to expect vacationing guests to begin booking visits again. At about 5, I was sprawled on the sofa. The howling winds outside were a constant reminder of the huge storm bearing down on the shore, and the knowledge that the power might not come back for days was unsettling. What about the food I had in the freezer back at my house? Was the power on there? I was tired, but felt like I had to stay awake through the storm, like I was protecting the house for Allison and Melissa. I don't know what I thought I'd be able to do if an emergency arose, but it seemed like the thing to do. I'd closed the flue on the chimney hours before. Paul rose up from the basement, looking like a man who'd just been awakened from a deep sleep. No, a coma. His eyes weren't focusing, and his hair was tousled. He blinked frequently, and his voice was raspy.
I've been trying to contact Sergeant Elliot, he explained. For that matter, I've been trying to contact anyone who knew him.
No luck? I asked. Paul tilted his head to indicate, well, maybe.
I got a message from someone who was in Robert's platoon in Vietnam. He said the soldiers there knew about the POW bracelets, but couldn't decide if it was a tribute to the missing soldiers or a protest to the war. They didn't care much for protesters.
And you couldn't find Robert either? Find out why he left so abruptly? It seemed to work. Paul's expression changed to one of concentration, and he looked directly at me.
That's the strange part, he said, as if the rest of this business had simply been routine. He sent me back a message that he's in the area, but doesn't want to come here and discuss this matter just now.
Why? I asked.
That is the curious part, Paul said. Why did he seem so intent on locating the bracelet just a few hours ago, and now he won't find the time to talk about it?
What about Maxie's phantom ghost? I asked. Paul looked coy.
I have a theory, but it is unsupported by the facts as we know them, he said.
Just then, a huge crash came from behind the house, shaking us and making a terrible noise that caused everyone, especially those not especially well anchored to the floor, jump. I looked up at Paul.
Find Maxine, I said, my voice a little raspy. He was gone in a second.
Before he could return, and before I could get to the back door to take a look, Allison and Melissa appeared at the top of the stairs.
Did you hear that? Allison asked.
It seemed a silly question. The noise was enough to wake Paul and Maxine, if I had stopped to think about it. But they seemed quite awake to me.
Paul went outside to look, I told her. There's no need for anybody else to follow him.
I could see she was already looking toward the back door.
Did you check on Mac?
His room looked okay. I didn't want to wake him up if that noise didn't.
I'm sure he's okay, I said. It didn't sound like anything hit the house.
Paul and Maxine, who was now wearing a black t-shirt with the slogan, "Well, blow me down," emblazoned on the front, emerged through the boarded-up French doors to the backyard.
It's not serious, Paul said once they were in the room. A very large tree limb came down and landed in your backyard. It glanced off the shed, but it didn't do any significant damage. It'll just take some work with a chainsaw once the storm has passed.
Allison looked relieved, but didn't say anything because we all heard a noise at the entrance to the den. Mac, in a terry cloth robe over a t-shirt with a picture of Jimi Hendrix on it, was coming in from his room. He wore white socks on his skinny ankles, highly visible in the remaining candlelight. He looked like either Cheech or Chong. I can never remember which is which. And what was weirdest of all, he was carrying the measuring cup I'd been looking for before dinner.
Is everything okay?
He asked Allison when he reached the landing.
I heard a really loud noise.
Everything's okay, Mac, she said, in what Melissa calls her hostess voice. There's no damage. Go ahead back to bed.
It's almost 6, he answered. I might as well stay up.
He started to walk toward us. What's that in your hand? I asked him, knowing full well what it was. Mac looked down at his right hand, almost as if he'd forgotten it was there.
Oh, yeah, he said. I found this next to my bed. Any idea what it was doing there?
I took the cup from him. It was empty. None at all, I answered.
And my hand smells like chicken, he added. Far out, huh? Made me hungry.
He laughed to himself. Maybe we should get some breakfast together, I said to Allison. The stove is gas, so there's no reason we can't cook anyway. Maybe we could make a little something more than just coffee. Would you like some breakfast, Mac? The guest looked surprised.
I thought food wasn't included.
Allison smiled. We make exceptions for hurricanes, she said.
Well, if it's not too much trouble, Mac answered.
You sure it's safe? Maxine asked. I've seen how you cook. Allison's mouth twitched, but she resisted the urge to glare in Maxine's direction. I can help, I volunteered. Mac had reached the sofa, and I stood up to start toward the kitchen. I'll do it, Mom, Allison said, with a tiny amount of edge in her voice. She's not interested enough to be a great cook, but she does know how to brew coffee and can make some breakfasts. Although without a toaster to make frozen waffles, I wasn't sure what else she could produce. But I decided to let her be the innkeeper and nodded. But Allison stopped halfway to the kitchen when she heard me gasp, and Melissa's eyes were fixed at the same spot that had caught my eye a moment ago.
the glint of light from Mac's arm. He was wearing a POW bracelet. Chapter 6. Everyone, living and dead in the room, stopped in their tracks. Not that the ghosts really have tracks. Everyone, that is, except Mac, who was auditioning comfortable places to sit. He settled on the easy chair facing the sofa.
"Is that what I think it is?"
Paul asked. I nodded, and so did Allison. His right hand went immediately to his goatee. Mac barely had a chance to settle into the easy chair and look up when Melissa saved us. Before he could notice he was the center of attention, she cleared her throat and said,
"That's a really cool bracelet you're wearing, Mac. May I see it?"
Allison's guest, who was being careful to keep his long robe closed all the way to his white socks, seemed puzzled by the question.
"Bracelet?" he asked.
"Yes, sir,"
Melissa answered, pointing at Mac's left forearm. Allison looked concerned, and Maxine moved closer to Melissa, just in case. She's very protective. He looked at it as if it were someone else's.
"Oh," he said. "Sure, of course. I'd forgotten."
He leaned forward as much as he could and held out his wrist.
"It's called a POW bracelet,"
he answered.
"Do you know what that means?"
Melissa stole a quick glance at her mother, and Allison shook her head.
"No, sir," she told Mac. "What is it?"
The older gentleman explained, as I had, the origins of the bracelet.
"I've had it for at least 40 years, I guess," he said, then looked at Melissa as if he'd forgotten she was there. "I've never taken it off in all that time. And it's not just nostalgia."
He looked at Melissa.
"Do you know what that means? Nostalgia?"
Melissa didn't look for signals from Allison that time and nodded.
"It means thinking about something that happened in the past and how you missed that time," she said.
"That's very good," Mac responded. "You're a smart girl."
Well, that was obvious, of course. But I held my breath a bit when my granddaughter pushed the question a little further, even as Paul hovered down to look more closely at Mac's face. Paul says facial expression is important when interviewing subjects.
"You're not thinking about a war, are you, Mac? That's not the kind of time you'd have nostalgia for, is it?"
Allison looked a little concerned, and Paul said,
"Easy, Melissa."
But Mac just smiled.
"No, you're right," he answered. "A war is a very bad thing, and that's why I spent years protesting it. I burned my draft card and refused to go fight a war I thought was immoral. Spent a few nights in jail for what they called illegal assembly and incitement to riot."
He seemed proud of that. "Did you go to Canada?" I asked, trying to buy time for Paul and Allison to think. A lot of the war protesters ended up there to avoid being drafted. Mac smiled strangely, like he was remembering something both funny and sad at the same time.
"Nope. The fact is, I had a high draft lottery number, and they never actually called me up. The whole thing was crazy. Just a product of the military-industrial complex."
I knew that was true of my husband Jack, too. The Selective Service System had set up a lottery based on birth date, and if you got a high number, you probably weren't going to get drafted. He'd been lucky. Paul, Allison, and I all looked at one another. There had to be a connection to Sergeant Elliot. But how to ask Mac? But then the guest looked a little concerned and made eye contact with Allison.
"I'm sorry,"
he said.
"Should I be more careful?"
he asked, and his eyes darted toward Melissa. "Don't worry about it. We're open to all points of view here," Allison answered, then looked at me. "Mom, I just realized the drip coffee maker won't be working and I'll have to make coffee on the stove. Could you come into the kitchen and help me with that?"
"Of course."
I stood and followed her into the kitchen, carrying a lit candle. I knew this was a ploy to get me away so we could talk about what was going on. Once inside the kitchen, though, Allison looked desperately at me.
"How do you make coffee on the stove?"
she asked. It was worse than I thought. My daughter actually didn't know how to boil water. "When the power comes back on, I'm giving you cooking lessons," I told her. "Not now, Mom." "No, when the power comes back on. You need to learn." I knew what she meant, but I wanted her to know I was serious. Teach Liz, not me. There's still hope for her. I filled a teapot with water and put it on the stove, which I lit with a match from the top drawer next to the sink. "I'm teaching both of you," I said firmly. Then I told her about the measuring cup, but neither of us could come up with a plausible explanation for its migration to Mac's room. "We'll ask Paul when we can," I said. "What do you think the POW bracelet on Mac means?" I asked Allison, just as Maxine was emerging through the wall from the den. "No clue," Allison said. "That's Paul's department." "Did anybody get a close look at the POW bracelet on Mac's wrist?" I asked Maxine. "Whose name is on it? Was it Sergeant Elliott's?"
"I don't think Melissa was able to see it, or at least she hasn't said so yet," Maxine reported. "And he's been moving his hand around too much for me to see. I can ask Paul if you want."
Maxine is always so eager to help. It's a wonder that Allison sometimes says she's difficult.
"It doesn't make sense," Allison said. "We need to get back in touch with the sergeant."
Allison got 4 mugs out from the cabinet, and I got some instant coffee from the pantry section next to the refrigerator.
4 mugs?" I asked. "Liz likes coffee now," Allison said.
I thought she was a little young. But Allison treats Melissa like an adult, and Melissa acts like one. So I suppose I can't argue with how that girl is growing up. The wind was still howling around the house, and we could hear the rain pelting the roof and the boarded-up windows. Allison had checked 3 times for water in the basement. She had 1 small gas-powered generator to run the sump pump if necessary, but so far it had not been needed.
Why would Sergeant Elliott suddenly need that bracelet? Why wouldn't he answer when Paul tried to ghost mail him? Allison continued.
"Ghost mail?" I asked. "I'm trying out a new catchphrase."
"Fail!" Maxine sang as she disappeared back through the kitchen wall.
Allison looked up at the spot, shook her head, and went to fill the cups with hot water from the teapot.
"Fail?" I asked.
"Okay, maybe we didn't fail," Marilyn Beachman said. "But you certainly can't say we succeeded in Vietnam." The television behind her in my studio apartment showed helicopters taking the last American troops out of the war. I had thought it would be a time for celebration, particularly among those of us who had opposed United States involvement, so I'd called Marilyn, now working for a local law firm. She'd come over after work for a glass of wine.
"I'm not talking about the country succeeding," I said. "I'm talking about us. We protested to the point that the government had to end the war. Isn't that success? I can take off this bracelet now, can't I?"
I reached for the POW bracelet, a little worse for wear, that had rarely been separated from my wrist for 3 years now. Marilyn reached over and grabbed my hand gently.
"No, you can't," she said. "Colonel Mason is still missing. You can't take it off until he's accounted for."
I stopped looking for the corkscrew and turned to look at her.
"But he might never be accounted for," I said. "I mean, I've gotten used to wearing the thing, but I don't want it to be on my arm forever."
"Oh, they'll eventually account for everybody," Marilyn assured me. "It's just going to take a while for them to figure it all out. They always do."
"Oh, yeah?
What about the tomb of the unknown soldier? Marilyn scowled at me.
You have a bond with Colonel Mason, she said, pointing at my wrist. Everybody who got his bracelet does. You took him on and swore he wouldn't be forgotten. It's your responsibility to keep that bond through that bracelet until he's found or declared dead, so he can rest in peace. That's the deal. You knew it when you put the bracelet on your wrist.
You put the bracelet on my wrist, and I never swore anything, I pointed out. But I already saw the logic in her argument. I had sort of made a promise, even if I hadn't realized all the implications at the time. And I was already seeing the ghosts of our soldiers, the ones whose bodies had been discovered and flown home, hovering almost everywhere I went. Some of them had been home long enough to change out of their uniforms, having realized they were no longer bound to duty. There was one outside the apartment as we spoke, circling a street lamp at about 7 feet off the ground. He was still in uniform and seemed lost. I guess when the only thing you can think to do is circle a street lamp, you probably don't have much on your plate. I felt bad for him and would have called out through the window if Marilyn hadn't been here. No one except my family knew about my gift. In those days, I thought I had to keep it a secret. As you age, you realize that what other people think doesn't matter. You keep that thing on, young lady, Marilyn reprimanded me. Don't worry. It won't be long.
I got it at Berkeley in 1971, Mac was saying as we sipped the instant coffee Allison had made. It was a trifle on the weak side, but I'm sure it was hard for her to read the proportions on the jar with this lighting. The bracelet was a way of protesting the war and showing solidarity with the poor guys, and believe me, the rich never went, who were taken up in the war. The wind wasn't whipping quite as noisily around the house anymore, and the gaps between boards on the windows indicated the sun had come up, although it was hardly shining brightly through all the clouds. There wasn't any point in being coy, so I simply asked Mac whose name was on his POW bracelet. He didn't have to look to answer. Sergeant Robert Elliott, he reported. Lost in Tua Tienhui Province, South Vietnam, on November 5th, 1970. Chapter 7. We would probably have questioned Mac much more thoroughly, but even Paul couldn't think of the proper follow-up question, so he finished with his coffee, which he'd barely sipped, and no one objected when he decided to go to his room to change his clothes. He said he might try to go back to sleep for a bit first.
There's no point in trying to go outside, after all.
Once he was easily out of earshot, Allison looked immediately up at Paul, who was pacing in a tight circle around the chandelier, hands uncharacteristically behind his back instead of stroking his goatee. This puzzle was truly getting the best of him.
Sergeant Elliott asked us to search this house for a POW bracelet with his name on it, he said, seemingly more to himself than anyone else. Before we could do a proper search, it showed up on your guest's wrist. What can we deduce from this?
He didn't seem to expect an answer from us, which was fortunate.
It looked like the old guy had been pulled out of bed by that lady ghost last night, Maxine chipped in. Do you think she was trying to get his bracelet off?
I don't know,
Paul said through clenched teeth. Melissa looked thoughtful and also a little worried, as Paul's agitation was pretty clear to everyone in the room. Maxine, hovering in the corner near the ceiling, chewed her lower lip and scrunched her eyes as if trying to see through the candlelight better. Allison sat down on the easy chair Mac had vacated and looked at me.
You're going to have to teach me how to make instant coffee, Mom, she said. I can't even manage that.
You do everything wonderfully, honey, I told her,
I'm sure the coffee was just sitting on the shelf too long. Those expiration dates are really bogus, you know. All of which was quite true. She smiled, but I don't think she believed me.
Could it be that Mac just happened to get a bracelet with Robert Elliott's name on it? Melissa asked. They made lots of them, right?
Paul shook his head.
Your grandmother says many groups did, but it's too big a coincidence. An investigator should allow for coincidences, but never trust them.
Isn't it about time you got in touch with Robert again? Maxine asked Paul. He can't just leave us here in a hurricane to sort through his personal business.
Paul's mouth twitched.
You're probably right, Maxie.
Without another word, he sank from the chandelier through the floor.
It was an elegant move.
He's off to check the Ghosternet, Allison said to herself. She stood up.
Probably time to turn on the radio and see where we stand.
Melissa brought in the car-shaped radio, and we listened to the news reports about the storm. It wasn't encouraging. Millions were without power, and we were advised not to expect the lights to come on any time soon. The weather forecast had improved somewhat, but power lines were down, whole homes on the shore had been destroyed by wind and water, and the winds would not die for at least another day.
Allison sighed. I guess we can't take down the window boards yet, she said. But I've checked on the basement, and so far we've been lucky. There's only a tiny amount of water down there. We haven't needed the sump pump yet.
Will the basement flood? Melissa asked.
If it hasn't by now, I don't think it will, Allison told her. Don't worry.
I wasn't worried, Melissa said, although I'd bet that she was. I was just wondering why it would be bad at other houses near here and not as much for us.
I think it's the dunes in the back, Allison answered. They were built up a couple of years ago. Was it when you owned the house, Maxie?
Maxine turned abruptly, as if startled.
What?
No, it was before I bought the place. They were already there. A beach erosion project, they told me when I bought it.
That probably kept the worst of the storm away from the house, Allison told Melissa.
Maxine looked thoughtful.
I'm going to check on the roof, she said, and ascended into the ceiling. That's always been one of her favorite places to get away and think.
That sounded like quite a branch in the backyard, Allison, I told her.
Allison nodded. I don't have a chainsaw, but maybe Tony will be able to come by. I hope their place is okay.
Paul rose up from the basement and immediately told Allison,
I think I got through to Robert Elliott. He might be on his way here now.
You think? Allison asked.
It's not a precise thing, Paul reminded her. It's more like impressions, feelings, not direct communication. Sometimes I have to interpret a little.
Since the wind seemed to be coming from the back of the house, off the ocean, Allison decided to see if the rain had abated to the point that she might take down some of the boards on the windows at the front.
We'll need as much light as we can get while the power's out, she said, picking up a hammer from a toolbox she'd taken out of a hall closet.
She saw Melissa head for the toolbox and held up a hand.
Hold up, young lady. Not a chance you're going out there yet, she said.
Melissa looked like she was going to argue, but I jumped in.
She's right, Melissa. You don't know how bad things are outside. If it's too bad, Mom's not going to stay out there either.
And I made a point of looking at Allison with a serious expression on my face when I said it. We all walked over to the front door to look outside. Our first post-storm look at the street was harrowing. There were dozens of branches, some very large, blocking the street. One had come down directly on top of a 1988 Chevy Monte Carlo that someone down the street had left parked in his driveway. A power line was definitely down. Allison's across-the-street neighbor, Mrs. Arbogast, had lost a whole section of her picket fence. There was a telephone pole four houses down, leaning at a precarious angle. but the rain had mostly stopped. And while the wind was still blowing hard, it was nowhere near the strength it had been the night before. Allison got to work on the front windows, and the light that came in as each board came down was a relief, beginning what we knew would be a slow return to normalcy. Paul hovered outside on the porch as Allison worked, and Melissa and I watched through the front window.
"We should have a plan for when Sergeant Elliot gets here," Paul said, pacing with his feet buried in the front porch.
"Why are you so nervous?" Allison asked him. "We'll get out the nice tablecloth and he won't notice we're serving leftovers."
"Very funny," Paul answered. "But this case has become very puzzling, and I'd like to have a strategy for our meeting with our client when he arrives."
"We ask him where the heck he's been, why he was so hot to get his hands on that bracelet and then disappeared, and whether he knows the deceased woman who was flying through my guest bedroom last night," Allison suggested, pulling down another board. The wind grabbed the board as she brought it down and pulled it all the way to the other end of the porch.
"Maybe I'll just do every other board so we can have light, but leave some up," Allison muttered to herself.
Melissa called through the closed window.
"I don't understand. We know the bracelet is on Mac's arm. Why can't we just ask him for it?"
"That's an excellent point," I told her. Paul puffed out his lips and rubbed his hands together.
"The real question is why Mac has the bracelet with Sergeant Elliot's name, and why Sergeant Elliot asked us for it."
"That's two questions," Allison pointed out. Paul ignored her.
"The point is, Sergeant Elliot must have known Mac has the bracelet. He asked us to find something that could only have gotten to this house with the man who wears it. Why doesn't Sergeant Elliot just reach over and take the bracelet off Mac's arm if he really feels that he needs it?"
"He doesn't want Mac to know there's a ghost following him?" Melissa suggested.
"Why not? Once he has the bracelet and moves on, it won't matter."
"I get that," Allison said in answering Paul. "But clearly Sergeant Elliot needed help, or he wouldn't have asked for it. What I'm really wondering about is whether the female ghost in Mac's room last night was there for herself or because the sergeant wanted her to be there." She pulled down the middle board on the last window and asked Melissa and me, "Is it lighter in there?"
"Much," I told her.
"How bad is the wind?"
"It's not that I couldn't see it, but it's not the same thing as being outside."
Allison hung the hammer in her belt and walked inside, where she could speak in a more normal tone.
"Not that bad," she said. "I think the worst of it is over. We'll see how long it takes for the power to come back on."
We looked back out onto the porch to find Paul, but he was gone.
"I guess he went to ask about the lady ghost," Melissa said.
"Ghost mail," Allison said. "I think she was still trying the word out."
Maxine returned first. She did not descend from the ceiling as I had expected, but instead came into the kitchen from the beachside in the back.
"It's wild out there," she reported before anyone could ask.
Allison, noting that the water in the basement was just a puddle, really, had brought the portable generator upstairs and set it up just outside the kitchen window, running an extension cord to power the refrigerator for a little while.
"Did you see anyone who needs help?" Allison asked her.
"No one's out there," Maxine answered. "But I got a little farther in a police car up and down Route 35. Part of the boardwalk in Seaside Heights is gone. The roller coaster is in the ocean. There are houses that are completely off their foundations, some of them all the way in the road. Trees are down all over the place. Nothing's open. It's going to take a while to come back from this one."
"The roller coaster?" Melissa looked upset, so I gave her a hug.
"They'll rebuild, baby," Allison told her.
"How'd you get back?" I asked Maxine. Maxine smiled.
"There was a really cute group of National Guardsmen coming up from the south, so I hitched a ride," she said.
What's going on here?
I recounted for her how Paul was presumably trying to locate the poor lost female soul Maxine had glimpsed, and that we were expecting Sergeant Elliot to appear at any minute. Maxine looked over at the generator.
Will that thing run my laptop? She asked Allison.
You mean my laptop? And yes, it would. Why?
I can do a little research on Robert Elliot if I'm connected.
Allison considered, but shook her head. Not without Wi-Fi, she said. We'd have to run the modem and the network as well as the laptop, and I can't keep all four of those things going at once.
Four?
Maxine asked. The refrigerator. I want to run it now so I might be able to use some stuff later when it's dark.
Maxine made a face, but said nothing. She might be impatient, but she's not unreasonable.
Paul rose up from the basement. I'm drawing a blank, he said. Nothing from Sergeant Elliot, and nothing about the woman Maxie saw. Has Mac come back in?
Not yet, Allison told him. He really hasn't been anywhere but his room much at all since he came 2 days ago. Except for this morning when we heard the branch fall, I've barely spoken to him.
He is an odd duck, Paul said. But I did get one piece of information I think might be useful.
And what would that be?
Sergeant Robert Elliott's voice came from the darker corner of the room, near the door to the den. And again, I was taken with how wispy his presence could be.
Sergeant, Paul said.
He gestured toward Allison and Melissa.
These are my associates, Allison and Melissa Kirby.
Melissa smiled proudly at the distinction. She loves being treated like a valued member of the team, and Paul always makes a point of doing so.
Robert nodded in their direction, then reiterated his question.
You said you had a useful piece of information? Have you got my bracelet?
We're not sure, Paul said.
We have seen a POW bracelet with your name on it, but it was not in this house until a few days ago. It came in on someone's wrist.
Really?
I thought Robert looked considerably less surprised than he sounded, but the light from the candles in the room wasn't great for reading a transparent ghost's expression.
Whose wrist is it on?
I think you know exactly whose wrist it's on, and I think you've known all along, Paul said, because the woman you sent for it knew exactly whose wrist to tug on.
There was something about that phrase, wrist to tug on, that triggered a connection in my mind.
Max said his hand smelled like chicken. That ghost was using my cup of pan drippings to grease Max's wrist and get the bracelet off, wasn't she? I said to Sergeant Elliot.
The sergeant looked stunned. His mouth flapped open a few times, and then he vanished into thin air.
That's becoming a rude habit, I said, even though he was already gone.
Allison squinted at Paul as if he were harder than usual to see.
What was that all about? She asked.
I wondered if she'd seen Sergeant Elliot at all, but she had been looking in his direction when he spoke.
Paul let out a nervous chuckle, which is sort of incongruous coming from a transparent man calf-deep in floor.
It was a gamble, and I don't usually approve of gambles, he said. But I think that one paid off.
How so? I asked.
I think I might have just solved this case, Paul said.
Chapter 8.
Okay, Allison told Paul. You're going to have to explain that one.
I can't yet, Paul answered. The sergeant will be back, and I think we can help him. But we need to do a few things first. Where is Mac?
In his room, I said.
Why?
Soon, someone will need to ask him to come out here, Paul said.
Melissa began clearing dishes from the island and putting them in the sink. Don't wash them yet, Liz, Allison told her. We'll have to boil some water first. The radio said some of the water supply is not being filtered because of the storm. We don't know if ours is affected yet.
Okay, Melissa looked up at Paul while Allison moved to fill a large pasta pot, which I'm fairly sure she never uses, with water in order to boil it for use later.
I can knock on Mac's door, I said, but he might be asleep.
You'll have to wake him up, Paul said.
Allison's eyebrows rose.
Why don't you do it?
I would, believe me, but Mac doesn't see ghosts.
He'd feel a bucket of cold water if we threw it on him, Maxine suggested. Her solutions to problems are often effective, but not always subtle. She's always trying.
You said before the sergeant came that you'd found something useful, I reminded Paul. But you didn't say what.
In a minute. Allison, do you think the refrigerator has been running long enough to give Maxie a chance with the Wi-Fi network?
Allison considered, then nodded. We can let it go for a while. It won't hurt anything. But there is some water in the basement, even if it's not much. I want to get the extension cord down to the sump pump and maybe pump out the water so we can be ready before it gets dark.
Paul seemed to agree. He looked at Maxine, who was already heading for Melissa's room in the attic.
I'll be back in a minute, she said.
Allison picked up a candle and headed for the door to get the things she needed for an internet connection. Paul, pacing as if there were a floor beneath his feet, appeared to be considering options. His eyes were almost gleaming, even as they were transparent. I'd rarely seen him look so happy. I didn't want to disturb his train of thought, and Melissa seemed fascinated with watching him think, so I said nothing. But the facts of the situation with Sergeant Elliot and the POW bracelet were perplexing me in a way that I think escaped the others in the house. None of them understood, because none of them, aside from Mac, were old enough to have been part of the era the bracelets were made and distributed.
You weren't supposed to take off a POW bracelet until the soldier in question was accounted for. Many people removed theirs, sadly, when it was discovered that the person whose name they wore had been confirmed as killed in action. Not nearly as many others received good news about their POWs, but there were cases of men, they were almost all men, recovered either from a prison or simply as part of a sweep of the area. It was years after the war was over for the United States before the bracelets stopped being fairly common sights on wrists all over the country. But if Sergeant Elliot's fate had never been confirmed, that meant Mac was technically right in keeping the bracelet on his wrist all these years. He was, in fact, honoring the sergeant's memory as he understood it. I knew a number of people who had taken off the bracelets without really confirming that it was time to do so. Having seen so many ghosts over the years, I'd been squeamish about giving mine up, and even when I did decide not to wear it every day, I had never really put it away for good. So, the question that I couldn't quite articulate yet was about the bracelet itself. The only way Mac's bracelet would stand between Sergeant Elliot and the next level of his existence, if his claim that the bracelet and the person named on it were linked somehow, would be if Mac had the only bracelet with Sergeant Elliot's name on it. That seemed impossible. There were many bracelets made with each POW or MIA soldier's name imprinted on them. I was about to ask Paul about it when Allison returned to the kitchen, carrying the small box that connected to the internet. I hope the towers are up and running, she said.
The internet doesn't work like a cell phone, Mom, Melissa informed her as Allison unplugged the refrigerator from the generator and plugged in the network. Maxine came down from the ceiling in her trench coat, from which she immediately pulled the old MacBook Allison had reluctantly given Maxine to do research on, and had rarely seen since. Maxine's clothing immediately reverted to her usual jeans and a black T-shirt, whose legend read, "Yes?"
"What am I looking up?"
she asked Paul as she hovered over the center island.
"First, find out anything you can about Barbara Litton, Sergeant Elliot's ex-fiance, Paul told her. I have a theory, but no evidence yet to support it. That's your job, Maxie. But if I'm right, it won't take you long.
She didn't respond. She just started clacking away on the keys.
This thing won't hold a charge for more than a minute, she told Allison, pointing to the laptop. Can I plug in?
Allison plugged the power cord into the generator and handed the other end up to Maxine, who rose a few inches as Allison extended her arm.
Very funny, Allison said.
What?
Maxine grinned as she reached down to take the cord and plug it into the laptop, then began clicking keys again. She seemed very engrossed, so I took the opportunity to mention my confusion about the POW bracelet to Paul. He listened very carefully, as he always does, and made a pyramid of his fingers under his nose.
Couldn't it be simply that Mac just kept wearing the bracelet out of nostalgia? He asked when I was through.
He seems unusually loyal to that period in time.
Maybe.
But why does that one bracelet make so much difference to Sergeant Elliot?
It's a good question.
Maxine snapped her fingers above our heads.
Ha! She shouted. This is interesting. I looked up Barbara Litton, and guess what?
She's dead, isn't she?
Paul doesn't often show off, but I suppose this time he couldn't resist. Maxine looked stunned and a little annoyed at having the spotlight taken off of her.
That's right, she said. She died 3 years ago. I don't understand,
Melissa chimed in.
How did you know that?
I didn't, Paul said. I suspected. There's a difference. When I tried to send out a general message and mentioned her name, two people got back to me, saying they knew a ghost named Barbara Litton, but couldn't be sure if it was the same one.
That was the interesting information you'd gotten, Allison said. Paul nodded.
But I don't understand, Melissa said. Even if Sergeant Elliot's girlfriend died 3 years ago, he's been a ghost for 40 years. What does it have to do with the bracelet?
You're so smart, I said to my granddaughter.
Well, maybe this starts to explain it, Maxine answered, perhaps trying to get a little bit of the credit she thought she deserved for discovering that Barbara Litton was dead. I tried to find a POW bracelet with Sergeant Elliot's name on it online. I looked on eBay and a few other sources. It's not hard to find them now, and they're really pretty cheap.
It's truly frightening what you can find out, Allison told Maxine.
You have no idea.
But you couldn't find one for Sergeant Elliot, I said. I wasn't sure if I was talking to Maxine or to myself. The fog was starting to lift in my head.
No, Maxine answered, and there were plenty with other names on them.
But before anyone could respond, I began to understand, and I started to think about the chicken. When I first saw Sergeant Robert Elliot, he was attempting to steal a roast chicken that he couldn't eat from a pan in Allison's kitchen, and his explanation that he was taking it to some homeless friends was clearly a lie. Later, Mac had found the measuring cup of chicken gravy in his room, even as he'd been pulled from his bed by the wrist that held the bracelet. I think the bracelet on Mac's arm might really be the last one with Sergeant Elliot's name on it, I told Paul. And as long as there's one on a wrist somewhere, the sergeant is stranded.
Chapter 9.
I think it might be time to go wake Mac, Paul said, because I think you might be right, Loretta.
I'll go, Allison said, and stood.
Hold on, Paul told her. We need to coordinate our plan.
Our plan? Allison asked. We have a plan?
Paul didn't acknowledge her humor.
I think you need an excuse to ask Mac to come out, he told Allison. Something that's not about the bracelet.
Tell him you're making lunch, I suggested.
That's not bad, Paul continued. He can't go out for food in the storm. Nothing will be open.
Mom, Allison said. She knew we had no lunch prepared.
I'm on it, honey, I said.
I went to the fridge, taking a mental inventory of its contents as I went. I took out the challah bread, some sliced turkey, and the leftover chicken from the night before, along with some lettuce, tomato, and mayonnaise. I brought everything but the mayo in my backpack yesterday.
We'll have chicken or turkey sandwiches.
I hope Mac isn't a vegetarian, but I can work something out for him if he is. As Allison left the kitchen to get Mac, and I started preparing plates with all the different ingredients so we could assemble our sandwiches personally, Sergeant Elliot appeared in the kitchen doorway with a sheepish expression on his face. Paul looked up at Robert with a quizzical expression.
Sergeant, I regret leaving so abruptly before, the new ghost said. I'm afraid I haven't been entirely honest with you. That was a mistake.
You weren't really searching for the bracelet, were you, Sergeant? Paul asked.
You knew Mac had it, and you were trying to get it away from him.
I need it, Sergeant Elliot answered.
What I told you about it was true.
You want to evolve, to move on to the next level of existence, Paul agreed.
But you need that one bracelet.
Is it the last one?
The sergeant nodded.
The last one still being worn, and that crazy hippie won't let it go.
On cue, Allison ushered Mac into the kitchen as I started to put the food out on the island, where Melissa had been busy setting four places.
Come in, Mac, I said. We've got some sandwiches for you if you're hungry.
Thank you, said Allison's guest.
He was dressed in a long-sleeved T-shirt with a peace sign over a tie-dyed pattern and had changed his headband to one in a khaki camouflage pattern. I noticed that Sergeant Elliot's lip curled into a small sneer.
Look at him, he said, pointing to Mac. He wears my name on his arm like another souvenir. Me and Janis Joplin are the same to him. He doesn't begin to understand loyalty, responsibility, respect. He thinks we went to Vietnam because we wanted to kill people. And now he treats us like a black light poster or a set of love beads.
At that moment, I began seeing a way to help. But I wasn't sure if I should try yet. Paul seemed to have a plan. I decided to let him try and see what happened.
How long have you been trying to get that bracelet from Mac's wrist? Paul asked the sergeant.
Over a year, was the response.
First, I spent years tracking down a lot of the others. Most of them, the people just took off eventually, and I didn't have to worry about them. They ended up being sent back, thrown away, put in a drawer, or forgotten. Their bond to me is broken and can't hold me back. But the ones that were left, there were only six, were easy enough to get. One person left it behind when he went to the beach, so I grabbed it. Another took it off for bed. Easy. I got the first five in about 2 years, including the time it took to travel from spot to spot. You can feel when there's one nearby. But this one, he pointed toward Mac. I've been with him every minute of every day for 14 months. And he never takes it off.
He looked at me.
Yes, that's why I was trying to get the bracelet off with some of the chicken grease.
I sniffed. My chicken is not greasy. But I couldn't say anything.
If the little creep had put that determination to work in the army instead of protesting and complaining back home, he might have made a decent soldier, the sergeant added.
Allison's eyebrow twitched. She's very protective of her guests. We sat down and started passing plates of food to go with the challah, and sandwiches were being assembled. I think everyone in the room except Mac was focusing on his left wrist, where the POW bracelet bearing Sergeant Elliot's name glinted.
"Was that why you asked your ex-fiancé to help you get it?" Paul asked. The sergeant looked more flustered.
"You know about Barbara?"
he gasped. Maxine seemed especially pleased with herself when she said,
"Barbara Ann Litton was born in 1948. She graduated high school in Madison, Wisconsin, just like you, and moved here to New Jersey when you were transferred to Fort Dix. You shipped out to Vietnam, and she stayed here, even after you were declared missing. She waited 6 years, then met and married."
"We get it, Maxie," Paul said. "Very good research."
He turned toward Sergeant Elliot as Allison, Melissa, and Mac discussed the severity of the storm, and I listened. Mac said the wind was mind-blowing, and I don't think he was being ironic.
"You started searching for the bracelets at about the same time Ms. Litton passed away. You must have found her fairly quickly. Why were you so eager to find the other bracelets?"
Sergeant Elliot looked uncomfortable and cast his gaze toward the floor.
"You know how it is. Some people come back as ghosts, some don't. When Barbara died, we found each other again and wanted to spend as much time as possible together. She was going to move on, she could tell, and it was going to happen fast. She's been holding it off by sheer willpower until she knew I could go with her. I needed to get those bracelets so I could go on."
Paul's expression indicated he had deduced most of that already.
"So it was Ms. Litton at work when Mac ended up falling out of his bed. She's been trying to help you get the bracelets, and she was trying to get that one off Mac."
"We both were," the sergeant admitted. "He's got it on so tight, it's a miracle he hasn't cut off circulation to his hand."
He looked at Paul.
"You've got to get him to take it off. Please."
I looked up at Paul then, almost involuntarily. I thought it might be time to give my idea a whirl, and I think Paul understood that from my expression, even if he didn't know what I was considering. But Mac was listening, so I wrote my idea briefly on the bag from which I'd taken the bread and maneuvered it so Paul could see it. He read it and turned toward the sergeant.
"Why don't you invite Barbara to join us?" he said. "Now that we know she's here, there's no harm."
Sergeant Elliot appeared to consider that for a moment, and then, apparently lacking Paul's ability to communicate telepathically, looked toward the ceiling and yelled,
"Barbara, it's okay."
I decided, having heard Sergeant Elliot's point of view, to find out what Mac's might be. "You know, Mac, I have a POW bracelet, too," I said, extending my arm with Colonel Mason's name imprinted on the metal hanging from my wrist. Mac extended his arm involuntarily at the mention of the bracelet. Paul must have thought that was my intention. I hadn't even thought of it, to tell the truth, and pointed it out to Sergeant Elliot. The sergeant floated down toward Mac.
"I did notice that, man," Mac said.
I ignored the fact that he'd gotten my gender wrong. People like him often call everyone man.
"You never found out what happened to your soldier either?"
That was the opening I'd been waiting for. But I wanted to hold my response until Barbara Litton, who had tentatively emerged through the kitchen ceiling, face first, to see if it was safe, no doubt, was able to hear what was going on. She made her way to Sergeant Elliot, who had surreptitiously picked up a fork from the counter and seemed to be trying to determine how to hook it on Mac's bracelet without showing himself. Whether or not he was worried about injuring Mac was hard to determine. Melissa was watching with fascination. Allison looked to me.
No, I haven't, I said. But I'll admit, I take the bracelet off once in a while. Don't you find that it starts to feel heavy on your arm? That it's uncomfortable when you're swimming or showering? I took it off to show him, hoping he might do the same. But he didn't.
Yes, it does get to be a real drag to wear it sometimes,
Mac agreed. Sergeant Elliot gestured to Allison to try and take Mac's hand, to raise it off the island so he and Barbara could get a better angle with the fork. Allison, probably concerned for Mac's arm, ignored him.
Then why not take it off? Melissa asked. She'd picked up on part of what I was trying to do. That girl is so quick.
Can't, Mac answered her gently. That would be disrespectful to Sergeant Elliot.
Sergeant Elliot and Barbara stopped in midair, literally.
What did he say? The sergeant asked.
Respect, Barbara whispered. She seemed very uneasy among other people, particularly living ones, and rose a little toward the ceiling again, perhaps considering escape if necessary.
Disrespectful? I echoed to Mac.
Didn't you oppose the war?
Of course,
Allison's guest answered.
But not the people who were fighting it. It's not like they went because they wanted to hurt people. I'll bet Sergeant Elliot didn't even know where Vietnam was before the war started.
It's true,
the sergeant said. He hovered, barely moving, directly to Mac's left, and turned toward Paul.
You knew he thought like this?
Paul gave a small nod.
I gathered when Mac knew just what date and in what province you had died, that it had been especially important to him. That's information that isn't on the bracelet. Both his and Loretta's show just a name and a date. He would have had to do quite a bit of research on the name he saw there, long before there was an internet to make things easy.
Maxine scoffed.
You call that easy?
That's very thoughtful of you, I told Mac.
You must really feel a connection to Sergeant Elliot.
Mac tilted his head in agreement.
The more I researched him, the more impressive he became, he said. From what I can tell, he was a good man and a fine leader of men. He was never found. His remains, if he's dead, were never brought home. I can't disgrace his memory by taking this off.
He gestured with the bracelet. Like I said, I'm not ashamed of my gift, but I don't often volunteer the information. I know Allison doesn't care to broadcast her abilities, and especially not Melissa's. But this time, I thought directness was the best solution to the problem. I looked up at Paul, who nodded his agreement.
Go for it, he said.
Mac, I have something to tell you that must remain a secret between us, I said. Allison's brow knitted, and Melissa looked at me with a mixture of concern and wonder, no doubt puzzling over what her grandmother must be plotting now. I took a breath.
I can see ghosts,
Allison grunted. Melissa suppressed a smile. Maxine, watching near Barbara, possibly in an attempt to keep her from fleeing, said,
Uh-oh.
But Mac seemed unfazed.
Far out, he said in a normal tone of voice. What's that like?
It's a great gift, and I cherish it, I told him honestly. But I'm wondering what you'd think if I said it might be a greater sign of respect to Sergeant Elliot if you were to take the bracelet off.
Very good, Paul said. I couldn't have done it better myself. Do you think he'll go for that?
Sergeant Elliot said quietly. Barbara Litton suddenly looked focused and interested.
Watch him,
she told the sergeant.
I think he means it.
Means what? Maxine asked, but no one answered.
Oh, I don't think so,
Mac told me. His right hand went to cover the bracelet in a protective gesture.
I'm keeping his memory alive. Taking it off would be a betrayal. With all due respect, I think I know Sergeant Elliot a little better than you do, Loretta. Can you understand that?
Certainly I can, I answered. But I'm asking you to trust me on this.
Man, I get where you're coming from. I do, he said. But you're not getting me. A lot of people took their bracelets off. You did too, and that's cool. But I think I'm entitled to my point of view, and I think the sergeant wouldn't want me to forget him. Why should I take off mine?
It was time, as Jack once told me when he was trying to teach me to play poker, to go all in. Because Sergeant Elliot is right there, and he wants you to, I said, pointing to the sergeant himself, a foot to Mac's left. Probably without thinking, Mac looked where I had pointed, though of course he saw no one.
Are you sure?
He asked. Very.
How do you know that's what he wants?
Mac seemed suspicious, though that was certainly understandable. Because that's what he told me, I said. Although technically the sergeant had been speaking to Paul. He says that he needs you to take off the bracelet so he can move on to the next plane of existence.
Wild,
Mac responded. Encouraged by his apparent interest, I continued. You see, in the afterlife, Sergeant Elliot has reconnected with the one woman he loved before he went to Vietnam, and she's moving on. The sergeant wants to go with her, and time is running out. Barbara Litton bit her lower lip. Mac looked at the hand he'd placed over his bracelet, just like Sergeant Elliot put his hand over Barbara's.
How do I know you're right?
He asked.
How do I know the sergeant is actually here? This little hippie is questioning me?
Sergeant Elliot asked. He looked at Allison.
Can I borrow a meat cleaver? I'll show him I'm here.
Allison shook her head with some urgency. Why not just take it off for a day or two? Melissa suggested. We can tell you when the sergeant moves on and you could put it back if you want.
That's not a bad idea,
Allison's guest began.
Wait a minute. You can see the ghost too, Melissa?
Melissa looked at Allison, suddenly concerned that she might have done something wrong. Allison gave her a little smile and mouthed,
Okay.
Yes, I can, Melissa told Mac.
I don't like the way this is going,
Sergeant Elliot said. The sergeant and his fiancée Barbara are both here, and they both hope you'll take off the bracelet. Just for a little bit, Allison said. This seemed to be moving a little too fast for Mac.
You too?
He asked Allison. Before she could acknowledge her ability, he put his hands up defensively and stood.
I'm sorry. I can believe in a lot of things, trust me. But all three of you seeing ghosts? That's too much.
He took a step toward the door.
I'm sorry. Stop him, Sergeant Elliot shouted. We've got to get that bracelet.
Mac, I started. But his gaze was clearly fixed elsewhere. Like in midair, a few feet in front of him, directly at his eye level. It was as if he had been hypnotized. He stared. He had good reason to do so. Two roast chicken legs were, to his eyes, performing a very vivid can-can directly in front of him. This continued, Mac's eyes almost rotating as he watched the motion, for almost a full minute, before the legs did a final leap into the air and landed in a split on an imaginary stage somewhere 3 feet off the floor. Barbara Litton held the legs there for a few moments,
then brought them back up where each did a bow, and then she made them walk back to the island and lie back down on the platter from which she'd snatched them. Mac watched them all the way back, mouth agape. Then, smiling, he walked to the counter and took off the bracelet, which he placed on the center island. He said nothing else as he picked up the plate holding what was left of his sandwich and walked out of the room. Sergeant Elliot looked at his former, and for all I knew, current, fiancé with awe. He moved to her side and embraced her. And then something seemed to startle them. Their whole bodies twitched.
"Is this it?"
the sergeant asked Barbara. She shrugged. "How would I know?" They started to rise to the ceiling. Barbara looked down at me directly and said, "We don't have much time. Thank you." She seemed to evaporate. Sergeant Elliot vanished in the same moment. But as he left, I could hear his voice saying, "I'm eternally grateful." And they were gone. The group of us, living and not, looked up into the ceiling. Allison's eyes and Melissa's were a little damp, and if I were to be subjected to a polygraph test, it might prove that mine were as well. Paul and Maxine stared for a while, then looked at each other. Their expressions were full of wonder, but something else, envy, might have mixed in. Suddenly, they were all looking at me. "That was amazing," Allison said. "I'm just relieved nobody in our family prefers the dark meat," I said. Chapter 10 Mac stayed for two more days, talking with us about our abilities and promising not to spread the word of his experiences before it was safe for him to drive home. After one day, Melissa suggested he could put the bracelet back on, but he chose to go without it, saying he didn't want to mess with the karma. I went back home the same day he did, and I was relieved to see that there was no damage to the interior of my townhouse and that the exterior damage was minimal. Jack, of course, was unharmed, but relieved I was home safe. The power stayed off for 6 days. I drove back to Allison's a day later, after she called to say her power had returned as well. Melissa still wasn't back in school, as the basement and lower floor of her school building had been seriously flooded. Life was coming back to the area, but slowly. We cleared most of the downed branches from her front yard, and Allison asked Murray Feldner, a man she's known since grade school who made his living as a tow truck driver and snow removal service, to bring a chainsaw when he could to cut up the huge branch in the back of her property. There had also been a great number of roof tiles blown off, so Allison was piling them up in the front yard when I arrived. I started to pitch in, but the bulk of the work had already been done. The scene between Sergeant Elliot and Mac was still lingering in my mind. "Imagine," I said after a while. "Mac thought he was honoring Sergeant Elliot, and instead he was holding him back. You just never know the effect you're having on other people."
"I do," Maxine said.
"Really?" Allison responded. Paul and Maxine were not helping stack the tiles. Passers-by would see tiles stacking themselves, and Allison was already known in parts of town as the Ghost Lady. But they were watching Melissa, Allison, and me stack them. Allison looked at me and sighed. "These are a lot of shingles," she said, pointing to the intimidating pile. "I'm going to have to go up on the roof and replace them." The Victorian is a very tall house, and reflexively I looked up.
That seems dangerous, I said. Gotta get done.
You could ask Tony, I said, of her contractor friend.
Tony's doing repairs on his own house, and then has about 17 jobs lined up. That's why I had to ask Murray for the chainsaw. Tony's just too backed up to come. Who knows how long it'll take to rebuild everything? My roof is the least of anybody's problems around here. Once the stores are all restocked, I'm going to get some shingles and get up there.
She didn't look happy about it, and I didn't blame her.
Grandma, you're not wearing your POW bracelet, Melissa said. Did you just leave it home today?
No. I've decided not to wear it anymore. I don't want to strand Colonel Mason the way the sergeant was stranded.
Well, you have the advantage of being able to see Colonel Mason if he comes to ask, Allison pointed out.
Yes, but suppose he can't, I replied. Suppose he never made it home from Vietnam and he's stuck there. I don't want to take that chance.
I think the best way to honor him is to allow him peace.
You're very conscientious, Allison said.
What's conscientious? Melissa asked.
Like Grandma.
Allison glanced up at the roof again and looked worried.
I thought about that when I went home that night. Allison told me a few days later that she bought the shingles and was planning on climbing up to the roof the next day to begin installing them. But when she woke up the next day, the roof had been completely repaired.
Epilogue. It was you, wasn't it? I asked Jack now, on our way to Allison's house for dinner with the girls, the ghosts, and Josh Kaplan.
Of course it was me. You knew it was me, he said, sitting in the passenger seat.
I'd had to talk Jack out of putting on his seatbelt, pointing out that there was little harm that could befall him these days.
I wasn't going to let her climb up there and break her neck.
You're a good dad.
Better now than then, he said.
Don't sell yourself short, I told my deceased husband. Your heart was in the right place.
Technically, my heart is in an urn somewhere, isn't it?
I didn't answer that.
You're still wearing that? Marilyn Beachman asked. She pointed to the POW bracelet on my left wrist. It was some the worse for wear after 4 years, but not rusted or dirty. I glanced at it.
We were at her apartment in Matawan, where she just moved to be with her boyfriend, later husband, later ex-husband, Roy, and Marilyn was cooking dinner just to prove to me that she could. Chicken parm. She was sautéing the chicken in preparation for the oven as we spoke.
You told me I had to wear it until Colonel Mason was found or declared dead, I said. I haven't seen anything that said he was either.
Since I'd gotten to the apartment and Roy had taken my coat and then disappeared into the bedroom, saying he wanted to let us have our girl talk, a sure sign that he'd eventually be Marilyn's ex-husband, there had been an incessant banging coming from somewhere in the place, but Marilyn was not acknowledging it.
They've found pretty much everybody, she answered. There's no reason to think he wasn't among them.
I rode away to the Department of Defense and never got an answer, I said. The pounding wouldn't stop.
What is that noise, anyway?
Oh, sorry, Marilyn told me. The super sent up some guy to fix the ceiling in the bathroom, and he's been hammering all day. It's making me crazy. But he'll leave soon. They shut down at 6.
You really wrote to the Department of Defense? Marilyn repeated with a chuckle.
You're so naive. They're never going to tell you the truth. Hasn't this Watergate thing taught you anything about trusting the government?
Well, maybe I should take the bracelet off for good, then, I said.
Don't do that, said a voice from behind me.
Holding a step stool,
A young man in painter's overalls and canvas cap was walking out of the bathroom. He looked at Marilyn.
"Ceiling's just about fixed," he said. "I'll come back tomorrow to compound and sand it, okay?"
"Sure," she said, stirring jar marinara sauce in a pot and not looking up. "Why shouldn't I take it off?" I asked the super's assistant. He had a small frame but solid muscles, sort of like John Garfield.
"Because it's a way of letting the guys who fought know that you understand what they went through, and you want all their buddies to get home safe, even the ones who are still being held prisoner."
"Vietnam was a mistake," Marilyn said. The young man shrugged.
"Governments make mistakes. Should we punish the poor guys who had to carry them out? Some friends of mine were there. Some didn't come back. I don't care about the politics. I care about my friends."
"I say you should keep wearing the bracelet, ma'am."
"Ma'am?" I said.
"Miss?"
he asked, and smiled. I decided right then I would keep wearing the bracelet for a while. And I married the young handyman the following year. Addendum. Lieutenant Colonel William Henderson Mason was born October 12, 1924, and was lost in Laos on May 22, 1968. His crew included Captain Thomas B. Mitchell, Captain William T. McPhail, Seaman Apprentice Gary Pate, Staff Sergeant Calvin C. Glover, Aircraft Mechanics Melvin D. Rash, and John Q. Adam. The crew departed Ubon, carrying passenger Major Jerry L. Chambers. Radio contact was lost, and the aircraft did not return to base. There was no further contact. Because Laos did not participate in the Paris Peace Accords, no American held in Laos has ever been released. Colonel Mason was a 1946 graduate of West Point and was promoted to full colonel while classified as missing. A group remains burial for the crew, including Colonel Mason, was held on June 10, 2010. Source, POW Network, 2010, www.pownetwork.org/bios/m/m019.
This has been an Audible Inc. production of An Open Spook, A Haunted Guesthouse Mystery, written by E.J. Copperman, narrated by Amanda Ronconi. Producer Mike Charzik. Copyright 2013 Jeffrey Cohen. Production copyright 2014 by Audible Inc.